Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
My name is Minh Vu. It's great to meet you, and thank you for having me on. I am a partner in the DC office of Seyfarth Shaw. I'm an attorney and also head of the ADA Title III team at the firm.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over. Thank you so much for coming on today. Can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and how your family came to the United States?
This month is the 49th anniversary of my coming to this country in 1975. We left Saigon about 2 weeks before the end, maybe a little closer. We settled in Alexandria, Virginia, where I grew up.
Why Alexandria, Virginia?
So my sister was actually already living there. She was getting her PhD at GW. So we kind of secretly took over her apartment, my parents and I, yeah.
And when they first came to the United States, did they come in through Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania? Why the East Coast?
Well, we wound up in the East Coast because my sister was already here, in Alexandria. But we actually were in Camp Pendleton. I think that was the first place we wound up in the United States.
So your sister was a little older then when she came to the United States? She came before the war?
Yes. So and actually, I'm number seven in the family. And I have six brothers and sisters, three brothers, three sisters. And there's a 13-year gap between the whole group and me. So I was a little bit unexpected. So they were much older and were basically, in the middle of their graduate studies at that point, when I was only almost 8 years old.
So they had come, or the sister had come to the United States before the war ended.
Oh yeah. All of my siblings. My mother was a genius at getting everyone pretty much into a college program outside of Vietnam. So they were all educated in the West, and then went on to get their graduate degrees also in the United States.
Oh, this is very interesting because, we typically think about the Vietnamese refugee experience as you come and you really don't know anything about the United States. Families come and they have to re-educate themselves on the ways of living in the United States. But you already had siblings that were here already, established roots here, that must have made it much more comfortable culturally for you and your entire family to come to a place to resettle then.
I mean, I would say it was easier, I think, for my family than others. There's no question about that. So I guess to give you a little bit of background, my dad was a diplomat in the Vietnamese South Vietnamese government. So he was actually in the Philippines when I was born. So my parents and I were there, and some siblings too. And then we moved to Paris when I was about three. We stayed there for until six. And then my parents decided to repatriate to Saigon in 1973, which is not the best time to repatriate, but who knew, right? So my parents and I came back, and at that point, my oldest brother had returned to Vietnam, and he was also working in the last administration, pretty high up, actually. So So we were there, until they were, until the end, and then we were in fact refugees who came over. But we were very lucky because, we did have family already living in the States, and so we didn't have to wait for a sponsor. And I had never been in the United States and had never spoken English, of course, when we arrived. So in a sense, I mean, I did have the refugee, no question, I had the refugee experience, but it was also much easier, I think, than many other families.
And as somebody who was the youngest of seven and had older siblings who really kind of went through this cultural transition a lot earlier, did you glean any kind of experience that they, kind of walk you through the things that you needed to think about as you were assimilating into the American culture at the time?
Not really. I mean, I will tell you a funny story though. So when we first arrived at Dulles Airport, whatever it was, I think it was still called Dulles back then. When we arrived, I just like sat down and squatted in the middle of like the baggage claim area. I mean, I still remember this. And that's a total common thing to do, right? In Vietnam. And my sister said to me, "Oh, we don't do that here." we don't squat in the middle of like the baggage claim area. Oh my goodness, that was so embarrassing. Anyway, I just still remember that.
How old were you at the time?
I was almost 8. It's a couple weeks to my 8th birthday. Yep.
You still have a lot of memories about Vietnam then, right?
Some, yeah. I
That
do.
that's a funny story.
Yeah. That was the extent of the cultural assimilation guidance that I received.
So when you were growing up in the DC area, it sounds like, right?
Yeah.
What was it like for you?
Well, so Alexandria, Virginia did not have too many Asians at all. I mean, so I started okay, so I arrived in May to the DC to Alexandria. I don't know exactly how this happened, but I wound up in summer school for remedial American children to learn English. But they weren't teaching it as a second language. They were just teaching it to English-speaking kids who just aren't very good at English, right? Because at the time I didn't speak any English. So somehow I managed to figure out how to speak English in like the course of 2 or 3 months and started elementary school in the fall. And then I watched a lot of television too, which was amazing. American TV is so much better than Vietnamese TV. And then and then I just started elementary school, and it was hard. I mean, like there were no other, well, okay, there was one other Asian in the entire school, and she was Korean.
And as you were coming up in the educational system, was there pressure from your parents to really say, look, here are the schools that you should be thinking about? Did they plant that in your mind or your siblings? And they said, we need you to be highly educated. Is that something that was culturally instilled within you, within your family?
Oh yeah, my family is super elitist when it comes to education. We have I mean, my brother went to Harvard. We have a UPenn grad. Definitely extremely elitist. The standards were communicated to me. I don't really know how, but I just knew that the expectation was that I would always deliver a perfect report card. Which I did most of the time. Occasionally there would be a B, and then there'd be questions like, why is there a B? I understood that they would leave me alone and let me do what I wanted to do if I just delivered the grades the way they wanted. And I did.
And as a parent of a child, I think your daughters had gone up through the ranks of the education system today. Do you think that culturally, that pressure to go to the best schools and the elitist sort of way of looking at it is a good thing? Because the debate is raging now, where I have families that I've or guests that I've talked to that have gone Ivy League, and they're like, we don't push it. We don't think that that's a healthy thing anymore. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's You know, I my daughter's 21, and she's actually in the middle of taking a year off, but she's going to restart at George Washington this fall. I think she herself put pressure on herself to get to a really good school. But my view, having now kind of seen, I don't know, met a lot of people who've been very successful in their lives and careers. I don't necessarily think you have to go to an Ivy League school, truly. I mean, I think it's more, I mean, obviously you should go to the best school you can get into that also fits your own personality. You know, there are a lot of kids who wind up in these pressure cooker schools and are completely miserable. They have nervous breakdowns. It's bad. I mean, I just don't think this generation is quite as goal oriented, I guess, as mine. That's just my view on this. You know, the people I knew pretty much just went to the best school they could get into. It was a job. If you happen to have fun, great, right? But really, your job was to go to the best school possible and make the most money possible. That was like always the motto in my family. It's like you have a moral obligation to do the best you can, make the most money possible, get the, be the best, of everything as much as is within your ability, right? I just hope for my daughter that she is the best that she can be and that she's happy. That's kind of more important. I don't really think like our generation ever thought much about happiness
No,
at
and
all.
I don't think we're kind of that freedom to think about things in those terms.
Well, right, exactly. I mean, right, exactly. When you're wondering like whether the rent's going to be made next month, I mean, happiness is just not a consideration, right? You're just worried about keeping the food on the table and the,
Yeah, but
roof
that
over your head.
so that's the debate that I have, because I have really young children, and I always think, especially when I'm talking to people like you who've gone through. Up through the really best schools, and people like Viet Dinh, our mutual friend, I've talked to people, and it seems like this idea of what we as a generation had to go through was there was no choices. You just really had to you our parents had to just survive, and we just found a way to get into the best situations, like our education, the as possible. But we were having dinner, Viet and I and a group of guys were talking about this whole new generation, and he was talking about his experience with the kids that were going to school with his kids, and he brought up a crazy story where last year or this year, this school year, three kids from that school committed suicide, and they were all, the most prestigious high school in LA. And we talked about the merits of actually pressuring our kids to perform the way we were expected to perform. And it's just a totally different world today.
It is. I think COVID actually, I don't know, it was really hard for the kids, I think. You know, especially the ones who were kind of on the, in their late high school years and or college years. I think it really had a negative impact on the kids. And I just think kids are just very anxious these days. Like just there's just a lot more. I don't believe, by the way, that oh, actually, okay, I'm sorry for rambling so much. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that I think was talking about some study that and that suggested that this generation of very anxious children is the product of overly protective parenting, right? Because the kids were not allowed to make their own decisions, take their own risks, figure stuff out on their own. And so having been kind of protected with helicopter parents for all these years, that they, are just much more anxious about all sorts of things, And it is amazing. I mean, when I was a kid, my mother had no idea where I was. Right? I mean, during the summer, I get on my bike, I go, that's it. I'm told I come back by a certain time, and I do, and that's the end of it. Nobody knew where I was. There was no way to reach me, and it was fine. And I had, and there was just a lot more freedom. And I think that that may have impacted kind of the state of mind of the whole generation.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak.
Yeah, my mom and dad gave me the keys to the truck and delivery van at 13, 14.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, it go. We'll talk a little bit about this, about developing countries and law, but they came from a place where there were no laws. So to them, there was no consequences to giving their kid the keys to the van to deliver garments, or we had to do a little bit of delivery when they didn't have extra bodies to deliver stuff around LA. So we were given the keys to the truck, and it never dawned on them that was like illegal. And then by the time I was 15, somebody at school had asked to, hey, are you open to driving my car back to Oklahoma for me? The kid had come from Oklahoma and went to school there and wasn't happy. And he said, "Can you?" So at 15, I drove his car, and nobody asked
Oh my
if I had a license or anything. And I drove it from LA to Oklahoma with two of my cousins, and it was fine. We got home,
Wow.
and
That's
so it's like one of
amazing.
those things where, I mean, at 15, we don't do that. We would never do that with our children today, right?
Oh my God. They have a record or something. What if they got stopped? I mean, their lives would be ruined. This is well, I'm a lawyer. I'm extremely risk averse when it comes to stuff.
Yeah, it's we live in a totally different age. So after graduating law school, what kind of sort of path did you want to take?
The reason I went to law school was pretty much because I, well, let's back up for a second. So I went to Columbia College for college, and it was the only Ivy I got into.
How
And
disappointing.
at the time, okay, honestly, nobody even thought about Columbia as an Ivy. I mean, it was like so low on the totem pole. I mean, it was in Harlem. Truly, it was not, everybody was talking Yale or Harvard or something, but it was never about Columbia. Now everybody's talking about Columbia. So I'm so happy that my degree has really increased in value over time. Anyway, so fortunately, I really wanted to go to New York. So as it turns out, it was the only Ivy I got into. So I got to go to New York City. I was supposed to become a doctor, as all good Asian children are supposed to be, but that did not work out because I was no good in the sciences at all. So I changed my major to English, extremely useful, and was actually got a publishing job. I was working at the very cutting edge Red Book magazine after college, and then another communications company called Whittle Communications. But at the time, I realized I'm never going to make any money if I stay in publishing. Just publishing does not pay any money whatsoever. So I had to do something to make money, and law school was pretty much the obvious choice because I was an English major. So I applied to law school and then went to UPenn. There was never, in my view, any choice other than to go to a big firm because, of course, I had loans. And at the time, you just pretty much, again, it's kind of following the mantra of, being as successful as possible and making as much money as
Go where the
possible.
money's at.
Go where the money's at, go to the most prestigious firm you can go to, right? I mean, that's always like the best. You always want to be at the highest levels possible. So I wound up, my husband, so my ex-husband wanted to be in Washington. So I wound up interviewing my third year and got a job at Latham and Watkins, which is a, well, at this point, like one of the world's biggest, most profitable, and prestigious law firms. Now, at the time I joined it, it wasn't quite that. I mean, it was still an excellent law firm with tremendous legal minds, but it has become even more. I mean, just more of everything, more money, more prestige, you name it. So I was there for 9 years, and then and it wasn't without its hiccups, honestly. I was supposed to become an income to become a partner, but then I had an unfortunate run-in with a new partner who had joined, so which is pretty annoying. I'm not I guess the takeaway from those folks who are watching this thing is, sometimes you have a plan, right? You think you're going to finish that plan, and then your plan gets derailed, kind of what happened to me. And you think this is like the end of the world. Oh my goodness, I can't believe this has just happened. You're so upset about it. But in some ways, sometimes in my view, every bad thing that's ever happened to me has actually turned into a good thing. I mean, maybe it's making lemons out of lemonade or whatever you want to call it, but it always kind of put me on a different path. And I am so happy, like where I am today as compared to where I was then. Because I mean, working at Latham & Watkins is like being a, a slave in the bottom of the galley of a slave ship, like rowing 24/7. So, anyway, so when I didn't make partner, I became a senior and of counsel, which is again pretty hard to get at that firm, but extremely annoying. I wanted to do something else. And so my former colleague happens to be Liz Cheney's son-in-law. Sorry, Liz Cheney's husband, Dick Cheney's son-in-law. And so he went over to the Justice Department to head the transition team for W. Bush, which is of course also, the same administration that Viet Dinh was in. So I reached out to Phil, who was in the same department as me. I said, "Hey, I've always really wanted to go work at the Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division." And he said, "Okay, send over your resume." And again, the story, I guess kind of the takeaway from that is, you know what? You never know kind of what relationships or leads are going to prove valuable in the future, right? I mean, I just kind of, it was totally on a whim that I just called him up. I was like, "Hey, and he's like, "Yeah, send me your resume." And we weren't like close friends or anything. You know what I mean? I just knew he was like looking to staff up the Justice Department for the political appointee jobs. And then one day, the White House personnel office called me up. Couldn't believe it. I was like, "Who's this?"
Wow.
I know. And then I got a job in the Civil Rights Division in the front office as counselor to the Assistant Attorney General. And I hadn't really even been a Republican of any kind, really. Jobs are usually reserved for people who have really worked hard for the party, one of the parties, right? But I think the reason I got the job was in part because I was, they probably wanted someone female and diverse because it is the Civil Rights Division. And I also had experience, substantive experience in the kinds of laws that, that division happens to enforce. So, I mean, it was a combination of things, but I was also extremely lucky and was there at the right place at the right time. Yeah.
When you were coming up, how difficult was it for a woman of color to rise up and come through the ranks like that?
Honestly, Latham was a pretty fair place, truly. I mean, I know, I mean, look, I know this is not true for a lot of workplaces. And I've been extremely fortunate. I mean, I actually don't think that being female has ever been an impediment, or even Asian has been an impediment to kind of moving up for me at all. Latham is a place where if you were good, people would want you to work on their cases. They don't care if you're blue, green, or whatever color,
So we can get into this. This is a very interesting point. What you just said about being a woman of color has never been an impediment, but you are good. You're good at what you do. You're bright. You're hardworking, it sounds like, right? So do you think that that is really the driving factor in the world, in any place you go to, is not really the color or who you are, but it's how much effort and how badass you are. Is that more of the deciding factor here?
Well, okay. If you put me in a law firm in Texas with a bunch of white men, maybe not, right? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, sorry to be so stereotypical, but I mean to make stereotypes, but you have to find a place that you feel comfortable in where you like the people, right? If you find such a place, and there are many places nowadays like that, okay, so different, right, than like 50, years ago. So many places. And then you're just good at what you do, you're gonna excel. All right. I think I've never sat around and thought about being Asian or Vietnamese or female. Now, occasionally you're going to encounter people who are going to behave like that, who are going to actually be they're the ones thinking about you being female and Asian, right? Not you, right? I like, you show up at a deposition. This happened a lot when I was younger and I looked really young. And you know what? People would try to take advantage of you. They would try to like, they would say, oh, she's female and she's Asian. I'm going to like be super condescending, try to throw you off your game, mentally psych you out. So they're the ones thinking they're going to take advantage of you. And then you know what? You just have to show them that you're going to kick their asses, right? I mean, that's it. Like, you just have to stick to your guns and not be affected by that. So it was more an external force occasionally, but certainly not in my workplace. Yeah. I mean, but again, I was lucky, like I was at a place. So at Latham, for example, I worked for a partner who's female, who also happens to be one of the top Supreme Court advocates in the country. So brilliant, so respected. She clerked for, I think she clerked for Justice Rehnquist. So there was no, I mean, her being female had nothing to do with it. People, obviously she was sought out and she was very well respected, right? And so I worked for her a lot. Learned so much. Oh my goodness, she was so brilliant. And I always felt like, no matter how hard I thought about a problem, did my research, I'd show up for a meeting and in 5 minutes she'd have like three new theories that I had not even thought about, right? And she, I would give her a brief and she'd in the span of a few days, she'd turn it around. It was like 10,000 times better, right? And you're like, whoa, this is incredible. But that's how you learn, right? You take that, you kind of soak that all up. You're like, okay, what does she do to my brief, to make it so much better? Like, how does she think about this? Or how does she phrase a certain concept? Yeah, it was an incredible experience, I mean, being at that firm.
What do you think creates people like that? What do you think drives and allows people like that person to become that good? And I ask that because I want to inspire listeners and I want to inspire myself. When we think about, when you just compare people and you go, well, how do we get to that point? Is it because they work harder or is it they're just like naturally just more brilliant?
It's all the above, right? I mean, to excel like at that level, there's desire to be the best, fear of failure.
Wait, oh,
There's
there's a
desire,
fear of failure.
fear of failure, right? Yeah, absolutely. Desire to be the best, fear of failure and public humiliation. Which, I mean, seriously, if
A
you're
driver,
arguing
right?
in court, I mean, if you're in court and they're asking you those questions, it's your biggest fear is to look stupid and be like, I have no idea what the answer is to that question, right? So there's fear of failure and public humiliation. There's just horsepower, like, are you smart or not, right? I mean, that's it. And there's the hard work factor, right? I mean, preparing, really thinking about it. So, and then finally, I think the magic ingredient that not everyone has is actually loving what you do. Okay, right? So if you have like all those other factors, but not the love what you do, you can still get ahead pretty well. All those things, because the fear of failure bit really drives you, right? and wanting to be the best, right? Being kind of competitive, you want to be the best, you know. But if you also love what you do on top of that, then you're unstoppable.
Yes, because loving what you do and you're attached to loving what you do makes the fear of failure even greater, because you're like, if I love what I do so much and I fail, I'm a complete dumbass, right? Because this is what I love. This is my brand. I'm on brand because I love this. And so everything else, hard work falls into play and all that. But then how do we as kids, or the young kids coming up today, kind of figure out where your horsepower is at such a young age? How do we as parents sort of guide them and go, this is where the horsepower for you is? It's not in biology, it's not in science, it's in legal work, it's in creative work, it's wherever, you know, and how do we kind of recognize that and kind of guide them along, even as a co community, you know, to instill within our parents, not our parents, but as parents, how do we instill find your horsepower? I mean, that's more of like the conversation right now. It's find your horsepower. So all the other things are driven by the horsepower.
Look, my parents, the parental role is really hard because you want to, sometimes you see it so much better than the kids do.
Yeah.
But you also, right? I mean, you see it. You know they're terrible at this, you
Yep.
know,
Yep.
or they're really good at that. But they don't want to listen to what you have to say, and you don't want to. And I get, and I, you know, look, I mean, I'm still grappling with that. And I think and also, you know, it depends on your child. I mean, some children need more guidance than others, right? I've taken kind of the Adam Smith approach, the invisible hand approach to parenting a little bit more. I mean, obviously when she was really little, yes, I made her do workbooks and things like that because she wasn't like, moving along as quickly as I thought she should. But later on, you know, say past age 10, right? I kind of let her do her own thing, you know, and it worked for me. And she did very well. I mean, she got into NYU and she went to Northeastern for her first year. She just hated Boston. So, I mean, you know, like, so she, you know, so she's kind of moved around and I think you have to guide them without being like overbearing. Overbearing. Sorry, overbearing. Yeah. It's really hard.
And now
And I
this.
think knowing that, like, I mean, knowing that, like, you're there and you're going to support them is really important. And that is not a concept I think that Asian parents, I mean, at least my generation, Asian parents are particularly good at. But you know, my mother has, okay, so my mother told me later that she decided to raise me the American way. Okay. So, you know, with the six siblings, okay, they were like in jail like the whole time. When they were in Vietnam, you know, the three older brothers were basically the jail keepers and the girls were like in jail. Everyone was in jail. Like all they did was go to school. Okay. They had no friends. They were only friends with each other. They did not hang out with any riffraff. She did not want them
Wow.
associating with any bad influences. This is why everyone's so insanely like successful, at least academically. And so yeah, so they were all in jail. You know, they weren't even allowed to hang out at the schoolyard for an extra 5 minutes to see their friends. I mean, they had to be home at a very specific time. She did it totally differently with me. You know, I had a car, do whatever I wanted. All I had to do was show up with a good report card, and that was it. Okay. And apparently my siblings were alarmed at the level of freedom I had. And she was like, no, this is how we have to do it in America. She's going to compete and be successful in this country. I'm going to do it the American way.
Wow.
She worked, right? She was very forward thinking. I mean, you
The
know, she said,
vision.
you know, you need to do like, yeah, go do be in the school play, play tennis on the team or do whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's fine. Like, she was, you know, so with my daughter, honestly, after probably age 10. I had no idea what she was studying most of the time. I did not know that if she was going to have a test the next day or exams or anything like that. It was on her to figure it out. And she did, you know? So now, not every child's probably going to work out that way. right? But at least it worked okay for my kid, you know? Yeah.
Well, we can transition from this to reverse back up to our parents now and the political sort of landscape that our parents are now going through. You said something just before we got into this about guidance without being overbearing. And I think it triggered in me this idea of how we approach Thanksgiving with the older generation, where we want to offer some sort of guidance, and because we sometimes we think that we are more informed, but being at the dinner table, you can't really show that. You can't really flex that you're more informed, and you start busting out the facts because they're not listening to the facts, right? And when we're thinking about the current sort of election cycle, we're having to deal with this a lot, which is things that are said at the dinner table. I have to be very careful that they're not looking at me like a know-it-all, and I have to really approach conversation very gingerly. And I talk about this on the podcast because many families are not talking to each other because of these political ideologies, and they're so whacked. The family dynamics today are so out of whack, and we need to find a way to come back to what's important. And I want to ask you, in terms of guidance and not being overbearing, somebody who's been in DC and worked in politics, what's the solution to this as it relates to the Vietnamese culture at Thanksgiving?
Wow, I feel like you just described like my last, my next to last dinner at my brother's house for Zoe, you know. I've got like siblings are all what like 70 and above, right? 70 and above, yeah. So they're really old, and then you've got kind of people of my age range, a few, right? And they're all, you know, super like they're super Trump loving types. I'm talking, I mean, they're election deniers. They are,
These are your siblings?
yes. They think Biden's committed all sorts of crimes. Not every sibling. So I got one sibling who's can't believe this is even happening, like in our family. So she and I are the only non-Trump people. Okay. And then the others, some are quieter, but you can tell they really secretly support Trump. And then there are two in particular who are just like, oh no, sorry, we actually have three Democrats. But one sister is never there. So, you know, so we got the three of us, but then we're not usually present. And then the others are like super arch Trump supporters. Usually we all just try to agree we're not going to discuss politics. And in fact, like I host Thanksgiving for some of my family members, and that's what I told them. It's like we are not talking about politics. So of course, inevitably, the two brothers wind up talking about how oil exploration is actually great for the environment. So yeah, somehow they always manage to get to some political topic, even if it's not direct politics. Yeah. So I think just meeting down the law that we're not going to discuss politics is the only way for us to have a peaceful meal. You know, crazy. I don't think there's any, I don't, I truly do not try to convince anybody to my view of the world anymore
Yeah,
because
and it sounds like it's not even how educated you are, because this sounds like these guys are super educated, your older siblings. Is that?
insanely educated, but crazy, like irrational stuff. I don't, the problem is nowadays, I mean, facts just aren't facts anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Everybody's got facts and facts, you know, it's just so difficult to have to convince anybody. I think people just have their views, and you know, I certainly don't want to be like that person knocking on doors and trying to convince somebody to vote for my candidate If they have already embraced a view, it's going to be
Yeah.
nuts.
I lean on the side of family relationships and friendships are much more important than the divisiveness of politics. And that's hard. That's lost on many of our, I have an uncle who's a diehard Republican, and my brother's the other way, is diehard progressive. And when they get together, they duke it out. There's could be 12 people at the dim sum table, and these two are the loudest people in the restaurant of like 300 people, and they're just going at it. But they love each other, and they have a lot of love for each other. They're good people. But at the end of the day, I think when I think about the larger community, it's not like that. It's arguing and fighting and cutting off, just bitterly. Not it's dividing, and I think that for me, I want to see. And I'm now on podcasts that are like conservative podcasts. I'll go on those shows, and I'll have conservative people come onto my shows, because I think that it's important to have dialogue, and manage our tempers. And really manage the idea of maybe we don't need to, as a person, give people our opinion. And maybe it's just our job now just to listen to what they have to say. And it's not because we're trying to reason with anybody. It's just giving the other side just some space to kind of like air out how they feel. That's kind of like my feel in this April, May 2024. This is how I feel. It's like no longer is it important for any of these people to know how I really feel anymore. It's just now, can you just sit there with your own thoughts and listen to what they have to say? And that's a tough thing to do, I think, that I didn't understand before I started podcasting many years ago. I would just go to town. My brother and I would just tag team and go to town with family members. And as a result, some of the cousins don't talk to us anymore.
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, I have friends who are Trump supporters, and we just try to, or family members, other, like from my current husband's side of the family, and we just try to stay off the topic, because at the end of the day, we have more important things to, to cultivate, right?
I live in, I'm gonna go over to the topic of labor laws and sort of government regulations. I live in a state in California where it's so difficult to do business because of all of the heavy regulations. And this sentiment of business people or people who are merchants or in the world of, you kind of have to like have a little bit of freedom to do certain things in business. In California, it's paralysis now. And with your background in labor and all of the work that you've done, I want to know sort of where the balance lies in government reaching in to try to help regulate and try to figure things out on a business level to help people. But at the same time, small business owners, are dying. And it's, you drive around in Southern California, and there's so many mom and pops that have shut down. And I think it has a lot to do with COVID, obviously, but I think it has a lot to do with the managing of these regulations in a state like California. You're on the side of, law, and you understand all of this stuff, but at what point is it really, really hindering the progress of the economic, because 70% or whatever that statistic is small business, mom and pops in America. Where do we draw the line, and how is this corroding, I think, our economy here, in the biggest state economic engine of the world?
I mean, it's a okay, so in full disclosure, I don't do any labor law. It's been a while since I've done employment law too. And I'm not familiar with California so much. I mean, I think that there is a lot of regulation to comply with. There's no question. So many rules, right? And the problem is lack of education. In some ways, in other words, these rules come out, and then all these small businesses have no idea that they even need to be complying with these rules, and then they get into trouble. And I think that's just not fair. I mean, I know you're supposed to technically be on notice of all laws, no matter, where they are or whatnot, but it's just not realistic for small businesses who are just trying to keep their doors open and stay alive. I mean, that's kind of the MO, right? And that's true. So my area is not employment, but it's Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So that is a law that gives people with disabilities protection from discrimination when they interact with public accommodations, which in lay terminology is any business that opens its web doors or its physical doors to the public. So if you've got somebody with a wheelchair user, a blind person, a person with a service animal show up at your business, you have obligations to them, right? Or a deaf person who needs a sign language interpreter. These are all things that, these are all, these are obligations. And what I see in my space is for small businesses, is there are very specific rules about the physical aspects of your business. The bathroom has to be a certain way, accessible for people who use wheelchairs. And literally, it's like the toilet roll has to be 7 to 9 inches in front of the toilet, or else you have a violation. Okay. Or there cannot be a trash can next to the door because somebody in a wheelchair won't be able to open the door because it's that space is necessary for them to pull up. Or, the grab bar has to be exactly between 33 and 36 inches above the ground. Like, so point being, and they're like, for any given bathroom, you've got, oh my goodness, like easily like 100 requirements that apply to that bathroom. And the code enforcement people are not the ones checking for that. So all through California, California is a hotbed of ADA Title III litigation where small businesses are being sued for these physical violations, and it's killing them. And it just keeps going because basically in California, there's a law that allows plaintiffs to basically earn $4,000 for every visit that they make to the business where there is a violation. Automatically, they don't even have to show that like they were impeded or anything. Well, they have to show that they were injured. They have to experience discomfort or difficulty, but that's not very difficult to show. So that kind of stuff. I mean, you'll see. I mean, in fact, I think I saw there was like a we review cases regularly, decisions, and I think there was like a Vietnamese business that was sued at one point. I'm sure quite a few actually.
Wait, can you go over that again? Wait, so anybody who has a complaint that files, what did you say about the $4,000?
Yeah, so okay, let's say you own a coffee shop,
Yeah.
right? And then there are these people who literally make it a living to go sue businesses. Like this, they sue hundreds of them a year. So they'll visit your coffee shop, not because they ever really want to patronize your coffee shop. It's just because they're basically going to check you out and then they're going to sue you. So they come in and let's say you don't have an accessible table, which is a table that is a certain height and width and with clear space underneath so a wheelchair can pull under. There are specific dimensions for this
Yeah.
kind of table. So you'd say you don't have that. And I don't know, pick something else. Like your toilet paper roll is too far away from the toilet. They can sue you in federal court or state court, and they can make $4,000 for that one visit. And you have to pay their attorney's fees too.
But oh, wow. This is the
Yeah, I no joke. And so there are I can't, thousands of these lawsuits each year in California. And usually filed by this very same people. It's not just like random people. It's like, who are real patrons. It's actually most of the time, it's these plaintiffs who make it a business, them and their lawyers to go around suing everybody.
So when you go into like that situation, is it just sort of like you do they have to let the business owners know like, hey, fix this
Nope.
and then we're gonna call off the dogs? Or is it just like they see it, they mark it and they prove it, they take pictures and they send to the lawyers and the lawyers file it? What
That's
happened?
it.
And the business owner
No, they don't have to know. There's no need to notify the business. There used to
wow.
be, yeah, there used to be, so there was an attempt. So, okay, So this is actually the Americans with Disabilities Act is a federal law, right? So that it, you can do the same thing and you can file a federal lawsuit. If you do that, you can ask the court to order the business to fix the thing. And you get your attorney's fees, but you don't get damages. But the California law, which is called the Unruh Act, piggybacks essentially, it's saying if you violate the ADA, then you're also violating the Unruh Act. And by the way, you get your $4,000 in damages.
No questions asked.
Correct.
No trial, no.
Oh, wait, there's a trial. You have to show that, like, you had an encounter with this thing. Yeah, whatever the violation was. Or, like it could be, like a parking space, a hand an accessible parking space that's not right. The signage is too low. The aisle is not quite wide enough. The slopes are not level. I mean, look, from the perspective of somebody who has a disability, obviously this is necessary. Otherwise, nobody's ever going to pay attention, and they still don't in many instances, especially small businesses. I mean, heck, I'm on an island in Florida right now where I can guarantee you if I walk out that door and drive down to that strip mall, I will find you 50 violations in 10 minutes. Okay. It just so happens that no one is running around suing everybody on this island because I don't know why, because there's no plaintiff living around here. Okay. And you don't get $4,000 per violation in Florida. Okay. So many other problems with Florida, but that's not one of them.
And that takes us to Vietnam, because in Vietnam there are no ADA, there's nobody fighting for, handicap people. There's no history of these sorts of the legal infrastructure to usher that in. But the economy is thriving. I mean, relatively thriving to if you compare it to the problems that we have to deal with in terms of small businesses in California. Vietnamese people in Saigon and Hanoi who are doing small businesses are kind of like they where's the balance that we need to find? And when you think of developing places like Vietnam, it's a free for all. I mean, and it's good for customers and it's bad for customers in ways, and it's good for business owners and it's bad for them in other ways. And it's going back to the idea of a legal, the trust in the legal system. How did we in America, how did Americans get and Britain or any of these Commonwealth countries get to the point where the legal infrastructure is so is as tight as it could be, versus I guess the question is for me, how is the developing sort of nature of Vietnam going to get to the place where, the laws and the rules are becoming more not bulletproof. I don't think they'll ever become as bulletproof as they are in the West. But how does it evolve and mature into a place where we can go back and feel sort of safe to do business or to exist?
Well, so many, I mean, that's such a packed question. I think government integrity is on your question of, how do we feel safe investing in the country, having a business in the country? It's obviously having a country that has, a court system that has integrity, right? Where people are really following, judges are following the rule of law as opposed to worrying about their next election and their election campaign. And that's why we always like being in federal court better than state court, because, state courts are usually a hot mess. A lot of those judges are elected, so they do what they think the people are going to like. So it's not necessarily going to be fair. Whereas if, judges are appointed for life, hopefully they don't really have any particular need to, satisfy any particular constituency, because that's the way it should be, right? unfortunately, I mean, let's face it, I mean, I don't know anything firsthand, but, you've got to be free from corruption. And at least, well, until recently, when we learned about Justice Thomas's, extracurricular activities, generally speaking, the federal judiciary is considered high integrity, right? We've and not corrupt. And even though the American political system may well be still somewhat, certainly not entirely corruption-free, but I think it's better than most countries out there, right?
Go on.
I think people, it all stems from the people too. I mean, the Brits, I mean, they're rules followers. You know what I mean? Like, there's this running joke about if there's a queue, then Brit's gonna get in it. Like,
That is like the complete opposite of
oh God, no, right. In Vietnam, they'd be like, how can I get in front of the queue?
front.
I'm
Yeah,
gonna
it's a completely different culture.
cut the line. Right. Yeah. I think it's cultural. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah.
It's
And
yeah,
so,
the worst, like, I mean, those Asians, I mean, like the Chinese people, my God, no personal space. I mean, like they're just like they're at it. Like
and
I'm
that's a
serious.
cultural constitution, right? That's like that's in the kind of the way it's like you're a dumbass if you stand in line.
Right.
Why would you ever stand in line? And in Vietnam, it's changing though. In Vietnam, I think it, when you're in the big city, a lot of people are international. They're moving, they're in and out of country, and so the idea of standing in line is becoming more of a cultural norm now.
That's good. No, that's really good.
But you're right. It boils down to that simple. When we think of the Brits, it's like, yeah, they stand in line, they look for the line and the order and the chaos of a country like Vietnam in the early days. It's that's just the way people are, and it's.
Yeah. I mean, you notice it even when you're driving. I mean, like driving in Italy, it's like free and lawless over there. I'm
Yeah,
sure in Vietnam it's
Vietnam's
even
the
like
same.
10,000. It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been to
Whereas
Vietnam?
driving in England, oh my goodness, people drive the speed limit. It's incredible. I was
Yeah.
over there last summer, and maybe it's because they have speed cameras all over the place, but I swear it was incredible. Like everyone was driving the speed limit. I was blown away. Compared to like driving on 95 going down south, and literally no one's driving slower than 90 miles an hour. And if you're driving any slower, you're gonna get killed. You know what I mean? Because it's gonna keep up with
Have you been to Vietnam?
not since we left. No. My dad was a former diplomat for the South Vietnamese government. My oldest brother was also pretty high up in the last South Vietnamese government. So I think my mother has always never had any desire to go back and was always very nervous about us coming back. I would like to go back at some point.
What's held you back?
I honestly, part of it's my job. I just can't take a 2 week vacation. It's just too much, especially in a such a disparate, I mean, such a far away time zone. I think I will go back once I retire, just for a visit. I've also heard, but I don't know if this is true. I've kind of heard different accounts that perhaps that the people there are not so nice to Vietnamese people who have left. I don't know.
No,
What
I
do you
don't.
think about that? What
Yeah,
have you heard about that?
I'm glad you brought that up because I don't subscribe to that. I haven't experienced that.
Okay, that's good.
Well, if you think about this is an actual fact. I think it's somewhere like 70. It used to be like 60%, but it's now 70% of the country was born after the war. So it's impossible for the bulk of these people to know or have any kind of hindrance or emotions about people that are returning, quote unquote. So if you even think about it, even you take up the statistic even more, the if you're at 70%, if you go to the next 10, 20% of the older folks, they were kids when this all happened. They could not have been as informed because there's no internet back then. They couldn't have been reading about any of this stuff. And I don't think the people in Vietnam take their government sort of, there's no government directive that says those people are traitors and they left the, there's none of that. I don't feel like there's any of that happening in the press. They want good relationships with Vietnamese American diaspora. A lot of the money gets sent back from the diaspora. There's no reason to kind of destroy each other in the international press level. There's always like building, you know, the ambassadors that are coming to the US from Vietnam are all working with different, like, you know, I'm intimately aware of like the Oregon community. They work very closely with the government from Vietnam. There's this bilateral relationships that are happening constantly all over DC, LA, and Southern California. Under sometimes it's under wraps and very quiet, sometimes it's very public. So the government is on the side of sort of building stronger relations with the Vietnamese American diaspora. They want to move product here. They're trying to figure out how to do it politically, where it's not like, you know, crazy protesting here. And I think it trickles down to the people, the young people in Vietnam. They're very welcoming. They're very, you know, I don't know, on the family level, of course, that's, you know, what goes without saying. Vietnamese people love family, right? So when you go back and I don't know, you probably don't have much family still there, but a lot of people have family there. And so the family to family relationships are tight. And when we think about like you go out in the streets, they welcome returning Vietnamese diaspora members. They view us as family that are returning home. But that's really my observation and my opinion. I don't know. I have rarely heard other people's experience of what you just described, that they don't like returning Vietnamese diaspora people. That's
Oh, that's good. I don't have a, I don't know. I don't have a view on that. I think my daughter would love to, you know, I think we would love to take a mother-daughter trip there. You know, and you know, how we do it, like with a guide or whether I still speak a little Vietnamese, I could probably get on okay, but you know, I have to sort that out. But I think that's definitely on the plan for post-retirement.
Yeah, it's like returning to your homeland because you were born there. And I think I'm so interested in how you will feel once you touch down in you know, in Vietnam. That's always such a incredible storyline to listen to. I'm always interested in hearing that sort of first time people touch down after being away for your lifetime, your entire life.
Well, I mean, I wasn't born there, but I did live there for 2 years.
Right. Min, thank you so much for sharing, you know, your life with the podcast. It's you know, there's things that there's small little nuances that, you know, I learn from talking with people who have this varied background like yours. And thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Yeah, of course. Well, thanks for having me. It's fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.